Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. In a few minutes, New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger will be here. He's been covering the Obama administration's retaliation against Russia, announced yesterday, for hacking the election and other spying. And he's been covering John Kerry's Israeli-Palestinian speech and the U.S. abstention on the vote on settlements at the U.N. the other day. David is finishing up another interview right now on another station, and he'll join us. And I thought it might be interesting for you to hear an extended excerpt from the Kerry speech that hasn't gotten as much publicity as maybe it deserves for the fullness of his position as he laid it out. Here's the soundbite that we do keep hearing in the news that was aimed at Israel. This is just 15 seconds of John Kerry.
Here is a fundamental reality. If the choice is one state, Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. It cannot be both. And it won't ever really be at peace.
Kerry, from his Wednesday speech that lasted for more than an hour, and that line was clearly aimed at the Israeli leadership's aggressive settlement policies on land that would almost certainly need to be part of an eventual Palestinian state, and in general, their waning enthusiasm for a two-state solution. But if you read or listen to the whole Kerry speech, as I have, I've read the full text, he's very critical of both sides for the ways in which they are erecting obstacles to a final status agreement that both gives Israel the security it deserves and recognizes it as a Jewish state, which the Palestinians won't do, and Palestinians the right to live in a country that's their own, not controlled by Israel, or where they have voting rights. So I'm going to play 4 minutes here where he really takes it to the Palestinians before going on to criticize some of the Israeli settlement expansion. There are several stretches of the speech like this. I've picked probably the longest continuous one and the most pointed, so you get a sense of the very long windup of context before Kerry's anti-settlement pitch. Palestinians among you, you might cringe. Here's 4 minutes of John Kerry.
This sense of hopelessness among Israelis is exacerbated by the continuing violence, terrorist attacks against civilians, and incitement, which are destroying belief in the possibility of peace. Let me say it again. There is absolutely no justification for terrorism, and there never will be. And the most recent wave of Palestinian violence has included hundreds of terrorist attacks in the past year, including stabbings, shootings, vehicular attacks, and bombings, many by individuals who have been radicalized by social media. Yet the murderers of innocents are still glorified on Fatah websites, including showing attackers next to Palestinian leaders following attacks. And despite statements by President Abbas and his party's leaders making clear their opposition to violence, too often they send a different message by failing to condemn specific terrorist attacks and naming public squares, streets, and schools after terrorists. President Obama and I have made it clear to the Palestinian leadership countless times, publicly and privately, that all incitement to violence must stop. We have consistently condemned violence and terrorism, and even condemned the Palestinian leadership for not condemning it. Far too often, the Palestinians have pursued efforts to delegitimize Israel in international fora. We have strongly opposed these initiatives, including the recent, wholly unbalanced and inflammatory UNESCO resolution regarding Jerusalem. And we have made clear our strong opposition to Palestinian efforts against Israel at the ICC, which only sets back the prospects for peace. And we all understand that the Palestinian Authority has a lot more to do to strengthen its institutions and improve governance. Most troubling of all, Hamas continues to pursue an extremist agenda, They refuse to accept Israel's very right to exist. They have a one-state vision of their own. All of the land is Palestine. Hamas and other radical factions are responsible for the most explicit forms of incitement to violence. And many of the images that they use are truly appalling. And they are willing to kill innocents in Israel and put the people of Gaza at risk in order to advance that agenda. Compounding this, the humanitarian situation in Gaza, exacerbated by the closings of the crossings, is dire. Gaza is home to one of the world's densest concentrations of people, enduring extreme hardships with few opportunities. 1.3 million people out of Gaza's population of 1.8 million are in need of daily assistance, food and shelter. Most have electricity less than half the time, and only 5% of the water is safe to drink. And yet, despite the urgency of these needs, Hamas and other militant groups continue to rearm and divert reconstruction materials to build tunnels, threatening more attacks on Israeli civilians that no government can tolerate. Now, at the same time, we have to be clear about what is happening in the West Bank. The Israeli Prime Minister publicly supports a two-state solution, but his current coalition is the most right-wing in Israeli history, with an agenda driven by the most extreme elements. The result is that policies of this government, which the Prime Minister himself just described as more committed to settlements than any in Israel's history, are leading in the opposite direction. They're leading towards one state.
Secretary of State John Kerry, from his speech on Wednesday, and he went on from that point to an extended discourse on the settlements and the Netanyahu administration. But I wanted you to hear the very long and very pointed windup to that section, because I don't think it's gotten any publicity. And I think this is a more kind of full representation of how Kerry was trying to scold, really, both sides in that speech. And with me now to talk about that and the Obama retaliation against Russia for hacking the election and other spying is New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Your article the other day had the kind of headline that we've been seeing in most places about the Kerry speech. Kerry rebukes Israel, calling settlements a threat to peace. And I realize you don't write the headline, but I think that was the gist of the article, too. But in the stretch I just played, he also rips the Palestinian leadership for all that stuff, teaching kids to hate, for bad and cruel governance of their own people in Gaza while they're obsessed with attacking Israel, President Abbas for saying he supports peace, then naming public squares after terrorists, all the things we just heard. Was the point not to dish to both sides on the way out the door to get their acts together?
I don't think that was the point, because if you've traveled around and listened to Secretary Kerry, and I've had the privilege over the past 4 years to travel them a fair bit, including in the Middle East, what you heard him say about the Palestinians, about Hamas, about terrorism and so forth was pretty familiar. He said that, and he said it in public, and he needs to say it, and he knows he needs to say it because it's all true. The news in the speech was that for the first time, and perhaps 2.5 years too late, the Obama administration decided to come out and say in public about what it's about, its fears about the direction that Israel under Prime Minister Netanyahu is headed, in a way that they would only do previously in off-the-record dinners and background conversations. And one of the big mysteries, and I think one that historians will deal with for some time, is had Secretary Kerry or President Obama come out and said this pretty much the same thing in 2014 after the collapse of the first initiative in this arena in the second term, would it have made a difference?
The pro-Israel argument, or one of them, is that the UN, much more than the Obama administration, has been one-sided. They passed a resolution in the Security Council condemning settlements like the one last week, but where are the equivalent ones condemning any of the things on Kerry's list of horribles that we just heard? And they probably have a point. Have there been any such resolutions?
There are a lot of resolutions that generally condemn terrorism, but I would agree. There are, you know, you do not see the passion behind those that you see on the in the Israel agreements. But the fact of the matter remains here that whether this is fair or unfair, whether the UN has acted in an even-handed manner, and I don't believe it has, or not, Israel has found itself increasingly isolated, and this debate about the two-state solution has become sort of a phrase that politicians utter because they feel like over the past couple of decades they've had to. And I think that the one of the merits of Secretary Kerry's speech was to call out the fact that the two-state solution at this point is really in deep trouble. And before you abandon it, you've got to think about what the alternatives would look like, including, as he said, I thought in the most important part of the speech, whether Israel is willing to face up to the choice of being either a Jewish state or a democratic state, because the laws of demographics suggest here that they can, will not be able to have both. They will have a majority Arab population if they do not find a way to do a two-state solution.
What do the Israelis say when confronted by that essential paradox? They can't govern a majority population. You know, they can't govern a completely democratically with a population that has a majority of Palestinians, meaning giving them voting rights, and maintain a Jewish state identity if there isn't a two-state solution. So something has to give, and pretty much it looks like it has to be a Palestinian state where Palestinians live or could live. What do the anti-two-staters, like the current Israeli UN ambassador Danny Danon, say to that?
You know, they talk about a one state in which you are you have basically a controlled Arab sections of it. And I don't hear much of a detailed debate that is rooted in reality, because just as our politics here are frozen on many issues, their politics are frozen on that issue.
Let's go on, since we want to do two stories here, to Obama retaliation for the Russian election hacks and other spying. I guess the newest development this morning is that Putin says he will not expel American diplomats like Obama announced he's expelling dozens of Russians. What's Putin's move about?
Boy, this was one savvy move, don't you think, Brian? So here you have the President of the United States step in with two steps. One of them is an old Cold War era. We're going to throw out 35 diplomats to in part because of the harassment of American diplomats in Moscow and beyond in Russia. And secondly, impose the sanctions on for the Russian interference in the election. Putin, by refusing to take up the suggestion from his own foreign ministry that they do the traditional thing and throw out 35 of Americans and so forth, is basically saying, I'm done with President Obama. I'm moving right on to Donald Trump. We're going to forget this ever happened. And by the way, not only are we not going to throw people out, but if the American diplomats here have any kids who want to come to the New Year's party at the Kremlin and see all the Christmas trees, they're welcome. So he is basically going to forgetting about Obama and just focusing on the lifeline here that he thinks he might be able to throw to Trump.
Right. I guess they're both being politically savvy, Putin and Obama, because politically, Obama boxes in Trump to the degree right. that the intelligence establishment and even most congressional Republicans see Russia as an enemy. So this is a potential threat politically for Trump in a serious way. If he's soft on Russia when everyone else is hard and the evidence is hard that they're doing things to undermine the United States, he could be seen as out of touch or self-dealing or friendly to authoritarianism. How do you see Trump's box on this after this Obama move?
Well, until Putin acted the way he did, I don't think that Mr. Trump had many cards to play, because one thing that he couldn't do, I think, was to go reverse these actions on January 21st, lift the sanctions and so forth. But now he can say, we've got a new opening, a new opportunity with Vladimir Putin, which is similar to what President Obama tried in 2009 when he came in and talked about a reset.
Yes.
So Donald Trump would not be outside the mainstream of American foreign policy tradition if he attempts that. His biggest problem right now is that his own party is deeply suspicious of Putin, and rightly so, believes that, in fact, there was interference in the election and that if you don't respond to it, that could come back in future years, believes that Russia has a plan now to try to divide NATO, is building up its military with that in mind. And at some point, Donald Trump is going to have to decide how he wants to approach this, what combination of opening and pushback. And so far, we have not seen any. We've seen bursts on both sides. I can live with an arms race. Or why not have a new friendly relationship with them? He's got to somehow integrate these views.
On the other hand, the Democrats aren't entirely believable as the new Russia superhawks. Their position always used to be that the John McCains and Lindsey Grahams of the world were too paranoid about every international threat or potential international threat, including Russia, and we should prioritize domestic policy and not make bigger enemies out of countries by demonizing them so publicly and in other ways. Now that Russia hacked the Democrats and Trump can, you know, potentially find himself in this box that could weaken him, Democrats are the new cold warriors. How much is that really about painting the election as illegitimate?
You know, there are some Democrats who were headed in that direction even before this happened because they saw the change in Russia since Putin came back in as president 4 years ago. But the election, I think, made them recognize that for a weak, declining, oil-over-dependent Russia, cyber had suddenly become the perfect weapon. Unlike the nuclear arsenal that the Russians inherited from the old Soviet Union, cyber is a weapon you can actually use. It's one you can turn up and down. You can use it to influence events without causing a kinetic conflict. And so for Putin, it's perfect. And he's learned how to move much more quickly in its use than we've learned how to respond. And that was the essential problem in President Obama's announcement yesterday. Nothing wrong with pushing back. The question is, could it have made a difference had it happened more than a year ago when the first major Russian hacks occurred and the FBI alerted the DNC, or maybe last summer?
New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger, as we talk about the U.N. abstention on the U.S. abstention on the U.N. Security Council resolution on Israeli settlements and the following John Kerry speech and the Obama administration retaliation against Russia yesterday and the Russian response over the Russians hacking the election and other spying. By the way, there's a local angle to this, David. You know this as someone with New York roots. They're kicking Russians, who now they're saying are spies, out of this compound in Glen Cove on the north shore of Nassau County. You familiar with facility?
Yeah, they sure know how to hurt folks. This was the only place where Russians could go and, you know, walk out on the beach and get a breath of fresh air because their movement is pretty restricted. And they've done the same with an even more spectacular facility that is on the eastern shore of Maryland that many Russians in the embassy here in Washington used that was actually in a great piece of New York tie-in, was the home of, I think, the builder of the Empire State Building.
And you're right. And people in Glen Cove know this facility because you can see it and it kind of stands out if it's the thing I'm thinking of. It's a 14-acre compound, 49 rooms, purchased by the Soviets in 1954. So there you go. A little more on that. Let's take a couple of calls on either of these things. Sam in Manhattan on the Israeli-Palestinian and Kerry issue. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, good morning. there could be a Jewish state and an Arab minority. It would just require kindness, less cruelty on the part of the people who live there.
Well, there's a Jewish state with an Arab minority now. The issue is if they annex the land that's basically the West Bank, they would have an Arab majority, or there's roughly, I think, the same number. David, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's now believed to be roughly the same number of Jews and Palestinian Arabs in Israel, including the West Bank. And so can it be a Jewish state if it's a state without a Jewish majority? Because then, you know, without a Jewish majority, the Palestinians would the majority would elect something that would not maintain it as a Jewish state in any meaningful sense. Right, Sam?
Please.
Sorry?
A Jewish state simply means a state that provides sanctuary to an endangered people, the Jewish people, but it doesn't disadvantage any of the other people that live there. By analogy, a sanctuary for elephants may have a majority of other animals that live there, but those animals are not disadvantaged. It's called an elephant sanctuary because the elephants are endangered species, just like the Jews are endangered species. Right. No one would be disadvantaged by calling the state a Jewish state in the sense that it's a sanctuary for Jews. No, Jews would have no other privileges, simply the right not to be hunted down and killed. That's what we mean by a Jewish state.
Right, right. I agree with you. But, Sam, the question is, can you have a Jewish state in the way and for all the reasons, you know, with all that recognition of history and how the Jews were persecuted in the Holocaust and everything else, can you have a Jewish state in that meaningful sense without a two-state solution so the Jewish state doesn't have a majority Palestinian population?
We have Palestinians. No one wants to harm the Palestinians. The Palestinians know that. No one wants to hurt them. There are 400 million Arabs who live in the world.
But then Kerry would say it can't be both, by that definition, it can't be both a Jewish state and a democracy without a Jewish majority population.
See, if the democracy is a kind, understanding democracy, it will not take away the function of a Jewish sanctuary. It doesn't need a majority to be a Jewish sanctuary. You don't have to, as I said, you could have a sanctuary for elephants. The elephants don't have to be in the majority to be called an elephant sanctuary. It just has to be understood that elephants can't be hunted, that's all. And Jews shouldn't be hunted either. There should be one place on earth where they could feel sort of safe. And what the Arabs need is not democracy. What they need is to be kind. Because democracy does not make you kind. You can have a cruel democracy. What you need is kind people. It's better to have a kind king than a cruel democracy.
Sam, I get your points. But in reality, minorities, whether it turns out to be a Jewish minority or an Arab minority, minorities tend to be oppressed in one way or another all over the world, which is the problem. Neither side will feel safe as a minority without voting rights, and Jews would not feel safe in a majority Arab country with full voting rights. And that's the paradox that goes both ways for both peoples. Does that call at all, David, replicate some of the debate within the area?
It does. I thought the most powerful part, or one of the most powerful parts of a genuinely powerful speech that Secretary Kerry gave, was his warning that that Israel could not be both a Jewish state and a democracy at the same time, just given the demographic realities. I think the point that your caller is trying to make is you would have a liberal democracy that was also a sanctuary for Jews, and certainly that was one of the founding concepts of Israel and one of the reasons that it was and remains so needed. But the question is, does that remain a liberal democracy if, in fact, an Arab majority population begins over time to change its constitution or change the fundamental purpose of the country? So, you know, I think that some of what you were hearing from Secretary Kerry was an urging of Israel to go back and think about its long-term self-interests. And his basic argument was, you're on the verge of throwing away the two-state solution. Before you do that, think hard about what the future looks like.
And Iman in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Iman, thank you for calling.
Oh, sure. Hi, Brian. Hi, David. So I'm Palestinian. I live here in Brooklyn. I'm a single mom. I'm a teacher. And I feel like in this whole discussion, you guys are not talking about Palestinian human rights. You're talking about the Jewish state without talking about the existing population. I lived in the West Bank for 3 years. I had to live as I felt like I was subhuman under Israeli law there. We were surrounded by Israeli soldiers with guns all the time. There were Jewish-only roads that we were not allowed to drive on. There was Jewish-only housing, you know, the settlements where Palestinians are not allowed to live, not allowed to rent, not allowed to buy. It felt like the Jim Crow South. And, I mean, if we're talking about the existence of a Jewish state without talking about the needs of the Palestinians to be equal and have the same human rights, then it's not a fair conversation.
Well, it's about both things. And when we talk about John Kerry's speech, I'm curious if you read the speech or watched or heard the speech, and if you felt he articulated that for both sides.
Well, I have so many people in my life who I love who are Jewish. I want them to be safe. I want them to have a home, but not at the expense of my people. So I would like both things to exist. But Kerry was talking about the inequality that would exist in the future if there was only one state. That inequality already exists, Brian. I lived as a second-class citizen there. I was not allowed to live or have the same rights as my Israeli neighbors. We were not allowed to live near each other. There is segregation that is promoted by the Israeli state.
Right.
If they allowed us to live next to each other, go to the same schools, even in the West Bank, that's what I think would end the conflict, is if people got to know each other and they were neighbors and friends, we wouldn't have this. But when you segregate people, not allow Palestinians to live with Israelis or Israelis to live with Palestinians in the West Bank, they will never get to know each other, and Palestinians will always feel like second-class citizens.
And I think what you say are also facts on the ground that aren't even disputed. But then a question to the Palestinian leadership would be, since the only solution to that is probably a two-state solution and, unfortunately, separation.
I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with that?
No. I mean, I might be a minority in the Palestinian community. I know Palestinians want a second state, and many people would probably disagree with me. I would like Palestinians and Israelis to live together as neighbors, just like we do here in Brooklyn, and as equals. And the problem with, with people who are terrified of what might happen in the future for, you know, another Holocaust, God forbid, or something like that, is they're afraid that if we live together as neighbors and as equals, there could potentially be a Palestinian majority in the future that would hurt them. But I think that if you live together and you love each other and you are neighbors and your kids know each other, I don't think that would ever happen again.
It's so interesting because the first caller, from a Jewish perspective, was kind of advocating the potential for a one-state solution, but that I think coming, you know, more from the perspective of the Jews would be in charge and they would need to be kind to the Palestinians. Your vision is a potentially one-state solution, a democracy, pluralist democracy, where by demographic trends the Palestinians would have a majority if they were to treat the Jewish minority kindly, and it would still be a safe haven for Jews. Problem is that neither side seems to think they're going to be treated with the other in charge.
That's why we have to live together, Brian. That's why they shouldn't segregate anymore. If the West Bank was no longer settlements and villages, Palestinian villages that are separated, that don't have the same rights as Israelis, we'll never get to know each other, and we'll never really know if that's possible. But if you allow people to live together, I live in Seagate in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
and this is a predominantly Hasidic community, and I am a Palestinian. I live with my Hasidic neighbors here. I am able to get to know them and see their beautiful children and say good morning. And we don't fight, or and it's because we live as equals. And when you when you treat Palestinians like they are subhuman, you will never have people who truly want to be neighbors and friends. The solution is to change the laws and to allow Palestinians to be equal. I mean, it will never change unless we feel like we are treated fairly.
Iman, thank you very much for your call. Well, David Sanger, we're going to leave it here unresolved, obviously, because when do we ever resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute and conflict? But, you know, we've heard a few impassioned callers. Any last thought?
My last thought is this, which is I think the first big decision that Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson, assuming he is confirmed, as I expect he will be, as Secretary of State, will have to make is how much of their own time, energy, and political capital are they willing to put into this problem. Now, it may be that Donald Trump, because of who his friends are in New York, because of what he's heard about, maybe he is willing to go to this to a degree that Barack Obama was not. It may also be that he has so much moved away from the U.S. position of being something of the neutral arbiter here that steps in to try to get the two sides negotiating that he won't be able to get off the ground with the Palestinians. I don't know. But that's going to be the big mystery in the first few months of the administration.
Certainly. And Trump has been completely contradictory on the campaign trail and after the election in saying on the one hand he wants to be a neutral arbiter, on the other hand he's going to be the biggest friend of the Israeli right that they've ever seen from the United States. So we'll see which Donald Trump actually acts as president. David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, stay with us.